like to do at this point is turn it over to Mr. Len Froeslin, who is our resident historian and expert, who's invested a lot of years of his life, along with some others, researching and studying the history of Glen Eyrie. So, Len, if you might come on up.
Thank you. We'll all be doing this because we're audio-taping it so we can send a copy to Bill Dale up in Canada. I would like to introduce some of our honor guests today. And this event was precipitated by their being in town. And we have with us from Victoria, British Columbia, three of this man's descendants. Mrs. Irene Bergman, on your far right, is a great-granddaughter. Louise Millman, next to her, is a daughter of Irene and a great-great-granddaughter. And then Judy Whitaker. Now, we've had General Palmer's great-granddaughter and two great-great-granddaughters here, and now we get this man's. And what a pleasure it is to have you. And then next to Judy is Jenny Kiefer, who is the curator of special collections and the archivist at Colorado College Tutt Library. And I have done a lot of work with her. Mr. Bill Dale is a man from Canada who has kind of initiated the volume of discussion and digging for information on John Blair. And as we go through the ceremony today, we'll hear more about what he has done up in other places of the country. And then we have Mr. Tim Scanlon, who is the senior planner for the city of Colorado Springs and does a lot of work with historic buildings. And we were just happy to be able to meet him, and we'll be working with him in the future, we're sure. And then Jeannie McGilchrist, the wife of Donald McGilchrist, who will be speaking to us momentarily. Happy to have her. And then Mrs. Rhoda Wilcox on the left, who is a good friend and the author of a number of books locally, and the one that we like and use the most, The Man and the Iron Horse. So we're privileged to have her with us again. We're happy to have all of you. Now, Donald McGilchrist has been quite involved in doing a lot of research as well, and he is more a historian of the property, whereas I've been dealing mostly with General Palmer and all people and things related to his time, and he's taking it from General Palmer's time up through to the present day. And so we're going to have quite a volume of information when we get all this pulled together in the next year or two. Now, if you don't have trouble hearing any of us, raise your hand, please. That'll help us, okay? So, Donald McGilchrist, thank you for coming.
Good morning. I think I'm a little too high for this environment. My very pleasant task this morning is to give an account of the fascinating life of John Blair, who, as you know, designed the original gardens and landscaping for Glen Eyrie. It's a special delight to do so in the presence of Irene, Louise, and Judy. We're thrilled that you could come and be here today. It means a lot. I also want to acknowledge a great debt of expertise and information in the shape of Bill Dale of British Columbia. He has become the leading expert on John Blair's life. This is a monograph, which we'll put over on the table there, written by Bill Dale, in which he researches the whole of Bill's life, of John Blair's life, and I would like to draw extensively from it today. What I'm going to do is just a historical sketch of John Blair so that you can know him before Glen Eyrie, at Glen Eyrie, and after Glen Eyrie. He was born in 1820 in a village called Callander in Scotland. My wife Jeannie and I were there 2 or 3 years ago. Beautiful place. And he died in 1906 in Duncan, British Columbia. He moved west when he came to the North American area from Ontario to British Columbia, coming through Illinois, through Colorado, and ending up in the Northwest. He married Jane Black in Scotland, and the two of them emigrated to St. Catharines, Ontario in 1851. And during the next 9 years, they had three daughters and a son. Canada was in a posture of welcoming British immigrants. This was after the War of 1812, and the more British they could get up there at the time, the better. But in 1853, the family came south to the town of Rockford, Illinois. It was still something of a frontier town, although it had a pretense of sophistication. And John Blair, who was already skilled at designing and constructing gardens, took up several commissions to do landscaping in Rockford. I want to quote from a contemporary account from the Rockford newspaper. Rockford contains some of the most tastefully arranged grounds to be found in the West. One is struck with the perfect taste, displayed in combinations of variety with unity and simplicity. Everywhere this is seen in nature, and rarely is it seen in the workings of man. However, I found on conversing with Mr. Blair, the gardener, that there was a mastermind behind all of this. This gentleman was born in Scotland, and he took his first lessons in landscape gardening from the forests and the mountains and the lakes of that land. His taste was formed by familiarity with those wild and picturesque scenes. So John Blair was a landscaper and a gardener, and his style was quite an innovation. It contrasted with what was then popular, the formal European geometry of ornamental parks laid out in squares and rectangles. His style was romantic rather than classical. You can feel it here. It was sylvan rather than striking, and it attracted many admirers. It was even considered to be a source of moral uplift. I came across this, or rather Bill Dale came across this, in the Chicago Evening Journal. Quote, "What a blessing to any state is the presence of such a man who surrounds our homes with scenes of beauty which silently educate us into the love of the true, the beautiful, and the good, and even exert a powerful influence in winning the poor, the dissipated, and the depraved to a higher and purer life." Have you ever thought that landscape gardening can do that? To lift the dissipated to a higher level of life? That's good, Katie. Yes. Yeah. Anyway, in 1865, the Blair family moved south from Rockford to Chicago, where he was preparing to manage some very large projects. 1865, the time of the Civil War. Many wounded soldiers were dying from infection or from the lack of clean bandages and adequate attention. And there were two redoubtable women, Mary Livermore and Anna Dickinson, who determined to do something about the inadequate hygiene in the Union Army. They began to organize sanitary fairs all over the North to raise money for the medical needs of the Union Army. They planned a large sanitary fair in Chicago in 1865, and they placed John Blair in charge of building a horticultural attraction just for the occasion. He constructed an extraordinary ornamental landscape. There's a picture in Bill Dale's book for you to look at later. It was packed with elegant islands, statues, fountains, terraces, grottos, bowers. Where do you think that would be placed in Chicago? They took 370 feet of Michigan Avenue, and they sealed it off for a month, and they gave it to John Blair. And he built his garden in Michigan Avenue. Interesting. After 1 month of exhibition, the whole thing had to be dismantled, and the street returned to normal. So much effort for such a brief time. But as a result, he was appointed superintendent of parks for the city of Chicago. So when he came here, he was already a very honored man in his profession. He laid out half a dozen important parks for the expanding city. Then what happened next in Chicago after the Civil War? The Great Fire, 1871. As a result, so much of his work was destroyed, and he decided to move further west at the age of 51 to participate in the very beginnings of Colorado Springs. He traveled with his friend Henry Austin, who intended to start sheep farming, and after whom we local people have named Austin Bluffs. They arrived at the springs in December of 1871. The first house had been built in August. The first train from Denver had arrived in October, taking 5 hours, incidentally, for the adventurous journey from Denver to Colorado Springs by rail. Most of the activity was still south of here in Colorado City. There may perhaps have been a couple of hundred people in Colorado Springs, if that. So Blair and his friend Austin arrived. General Palmer's large adobe and wood house was still a couple of months from completion. They were working on it that December, and it was concluded in February 1872. There wouldn't have been any progress in the making of improvements to this valley at that early stage. Furthermore, even if there had been, they might not have survived, because we know from the diaries of the Chambers family, who farmed Rockledge Ranch, that this area experienced a plague of grasshoppers for 3 successive years in the late 1870s, and it literally destroyed all the grass, everything that was green. The Chambers had to switch to dairy farming, so we wouldn't have had much landscaping if it had been done in the early 70s. So what was John Blair doing? He made friends with General Palmer almost immediately, and his first commission from the general was to lay out the streets of Manitou Springs, what is now Manitou Springs. Our local newspaper reported in June of 1872 that, quote, Mr. Blair, the landscape gardener, and Mr. Nettleton, the resident engineer of the Colorado Springs Company, are engaged in laying out a small town close to the soda springs at Manitou. About 150 lots are being laid out, and also 400 to 500 villa sites. When the layout of the little town has been completed, Mr. Blair will put on a large force to supplement the natural beauties of the glen. Roads and paths, bridges will be built, rustic seats will be placed in appropriate spots, and the new hotel is rapidly approaching completion. Note you can hear John Blair's style even in the reporter. He calls the Valley of the Fountain going through Manitou a glen. And he got the reporter to call it a glen. So there were several glens around here, apparently. And there were bridges and rustic seats. John Blair was big on rustic seats and bowers and so on. And there are pictures we have on the table there of some of his work. He also worked on the landscaping of Colorado Springs itself, especially the north and south parks, Acacia Park and where the Pioneers Museum now is. What is our current Acacia Park was set aside in those early days as an experimental, what we would call in England, allotments. That is, areas for people to come, plant a few seeds, see if they worked. People were trying to find out in the first years of the city what would grow here on the arid mesa and what would not. So Antlers Park, or Acacia Park rather, was an experimental garden area where newcomers could conduct tests to see what would grow. The general also employed John Blair to lay out Evergreen Cemetery. He also designed the gardens of Briarhurst, the home of his friend Dr. Bell from Scotland. And finally, he built the current winding road that snakes through the Garden of the Gods south of here from Manitou Springs to Glen Eyrie. All of that was done by John Blair. He was not only a gardener, he was a landscape architect. And there's quite an importance, I think, in the fullness of those words. In the middle of the 1870s, he purchased the land north of Glen Eyrie, which is now occupied by the Flying W Ranch. He decided to call it Blair Athol. This was an amusing reference to his own name, Blair, but also to Blair Castle, because he'd come from Perthshire, and the home, the ancestral magnificent home of the Dukes of Athol, just north of where John Blair grew up, is in the village of Blair Athol. And that's why he called this place north of here Blair Athol. I was puzzled by one thing until last weekend. I was probably puzzled by several things. But one thing I solved, I always wondered why John Blair, on the correspondence and the maps, spelt Blair Athol with just one L, his piece of property, whereas if you go to Scotland, Blair Athol is spelt with two L's. Well, last weekend I discovered that the 6th Duke of Athol, who was the presiding duke when John Blair decided to emigrate to North America, was eccentric. Most dukes are, but he was especially eccentric. And his name was Lord Glenlyon, and he insisted on spelling Athol with one L. So I think that John Blair was suitably brainwashed as he came here that this was the way to spell it. This was a very interesting man, by the way, Lord Glenlyon, Duke of Athol. He led his men at the last tournament ever held in Britain, real tournament, not just for the tourists. He sustained severe damage to his right hand at the time. And in 1845, Queen Victoria granted to the Duke of Athol, this gentleman, colors to form his own private bodyguard, the Athol Highlanders. And they still exist. They're the only private army in Great Britain. There are four companies of 40 men, and I've seen them parade, and they're very, very proud of this unique honor. I don't think they do any fighting nowadays, but they're still his private bodyguard. Okay, back to this cabin. This cabin, which we are dedicating, was probably built in the 1870s. As Blair's relationship with General Palmer became closer, he must have turned from doing work in the town, laying out Manitou, laying out the springs, laying out Evergreen Cemetery, to give direct attention to the landscaping of Glenelg. And so he placed and he built this cabin in a commanding position just across 30th Street, up on the mesa, just south of the reservoirs. The foundations are still visible, and there are two or three ornamental trees which he must have planted still growing up there on private land. This cabin must have been very small for his family. Remember that I told you that he had four children, and it was probably only a temporary home for him while the work actually proceeded on Glenelg. And doubtless it's been, of course, much modified. I think it was a temporary home because we know that by 1882, the Blair family was living at a home in the 400 block of Colorado Avenue. Unfortunately, that's now a parking lot, but we know precisely where it was. We also know that in the early 1880s, John Blair was moving down the valley of Camp Creek here, building arched stone bridges at intervals as he continued to beautify the property. This was the year in which the schoolhouse was erected, and there was originally, believe it or not, between the schoolhouse and the castle, a large ornamental pond. And across the creek fed into it and then fed out down the other side. And across that pond, we have pictures of it, Blair built a marvelous bridge. It was all of cedar, intertwined cedar. It was a very strong construction, but it arched over probably 20 to 25 feet. And it was a beautiful sample of his love for trees, his ability to handle them well, and his love of the rustic style. In fact, he specialized in ponds and rustic bridges. In this small glen, Camp Creek nourished a willow pond that he built where the castle car park now is, the bridge pond I've talked about, a duck pond just south of the carriage house, a lakelet where the sports green now is, two fish ponds near the gate, and seven bridges. We know the names of five of John Blair's bridges: Kitchen Bridge, Canyon Bridge, Schoolhouse Bridge, House Bridge, and Gypsum Bridge. All seven of them he built. The bridges we now have are not original. Why not? Flash floods. Flash floods have destroyed much of his landscaping work in the Glen. The 1921 flood, for example, destroyed the trail that led up the canyon to Eagle Lake and destroyed the schoolhouse bridge that I've described. Now, this has been our curse in Glenelg. Every 20, 30 years or so, we have a major flood that comes through and wipes out most of what is in the floodplain here. But he was a man of ponds and lakes and bridges. And incidentally, ponds are catching on again in our city. tomorrow, the Pikes Peak Water Garden Society will offer us its annual tour through a dozen local gardens that have waterfalls and ponds in them. The worst flood we ever encountered in Glen Eyrie was in 1947. It completely destroyed all the lawns, took out 4 of the 7 rock bridges, destroyed the reflecting pools, and a contemporary account says that thousands of tons of boulders and gravel had to be hauled away. In fact, to show you how serious this is, the value of Glen Eyrie in 1946 for insurance purposes was $550,000. After the flood, the value was said to be $100,000 for salvage purposes. 80% of the value, from an insurance company's point of view, was wiped away. So we've had a lot of reworking and rebuilding to do over the years. A typical Blair landscape, such as the landscape you would see here in the late 70s and the 80s, was full of deciduous trees. These conifers are more recent. He was planting them, but they were nothing like maturity. The color pictures over there of the glen, even in the 1920s, will show you how different it is from what it is now. There were seats and there were paths everywhere. He worked here until 1882. So basically, he arrived in 1871. He ceased his major work in 1882. He then went to San Francisco. He wanted to meet Luther Burbank, the world's leading hybridizer of plants and the developer of a famous nursery garden in Santa Rosa. And he learned while he was in San Francisco about the opening of the southern half of Vancouver Island. The virgin forest was being cut down and opened for habitation by the Dunsmuir family. They owned the Palace Hotel in San Francisco, where John Blair stayed. He got to meet one of the Dunsmuir sons. The Dunsmuirs had made their money in coal mining. They mined their coal in British Columbia, and they shipped it south to San Francisco and California. So Blair, still accompanied by his friend Henry Austin, traveled north from San Francisco and went back up to British Columbia, and both of them purchased forest land there. Again, true to form, he built a log cabin. He loved log cabins. And he built it 4 miles west of the present city of Duncan. He cleared space for a garden, and he planted many exotic fruit trees, some of which are still there, as the family knows. Catalpa, sequoia, cypress, hickory, walnut. And there he lived, surrounded by his grove of trees in his cabin, until his death in 1906. He had continued to visit Chicago while he lived here in the 1870s, and had held on to his home in Oak Park, Chicago, until it was purchased in 1889 by the young Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect. Lloyd Wright was very, very attracted by the beautiful trees that Blair had planted on the lot. And so Wright purchased it, and he built his home and his studio. They're now a National Historic Landmark there in Oak Park, and John Blair's house is also on that piece of property and stands beside them still. So just as Blair had commuted to Chicago from Colorado Springs, so now that he was set up in the 1880s and 90s in British Columbia, he would commute back to Colorado Springs from there. We know that he worked on our main gateway, for example, in 1883. He supervised the construction of the gate that we have there. And he came several more times. His last visit to Glen Eyrie was in 1900. John Blair and General Palmer shared a great love for trees. One of the interesting things about General Palmer is that he was, until his death, the president of the International Society of Arboriculture, the culture of trees. And he was described as, quote, a lover of trees and flowers, thoroughly versed in the character, habits, and origins of all forest trees and plants. So I think you can see why Blair and Palmer were friends. They were on the same wavelength. It is said, of course, that John Blair proposed the name Glen Eyrie. In the Scots language, this would be Valley of the Eagle's Nest. When John Blair took his family back to Canada and located in British Columbia, he sold Blair Athol up the road here to a certain Captain de Courcy. That was in 1882. But he didn't hold on to it long, and in 1891, General Palmer was able to purchase it, 160 acres, for the sum of $10,000. All through the 1890s, Palmer was extending his holdings north of the Glen into various ranches. What is now 30th Street, the street on which you came in this morning, was then known as the modern Woodman of America Road, because it connected old Colorado City with the modern Woodman property, which is up in the extreme north of the city. And it was on that road that John Blair built the rustic bridge, which is still there just outside Glen Eyrie, and which was officially dedicated with the Palmer Foundation as a gift from the Hill family in 1980. I would suggest to you that that may be the oldest bridge on public land in the state of Colorado. It's been, of course, refurbished subsequently, but it's probably to be dated at 1880. Blair's cabin was still up on the mesa and remained there for many years. We know that an Irishman by the name of Mr. Horahoe lived in it. His job was to maintain the lawns of Glen Eyrie in the early part of this century. But in as late as 1938, this dear old building was still in sufficiently good state to be worth moving down from the mesa to where it now is. This was done in 1938. I have a description from one of the young men who took part in the operation, and it lasted a full day because you cannot bring this building through the main gates. It's too narrow, so it had to go round. And the operation was supervised by a gentleman known as Old Man Miles, who apparently made a specialty of moving buildings. So it was established here in 1838. By then, George Strake had arrived. He was remodeling the Pink House and extending it. But meanwhile, his children typically lived in the summers in this building until the Pink House was operational for a big family. So in conclusion, let me just go back to Canada and finish up John Blair's accomplishments towards the end of his life. They're very significant. In 1888, for example, the city of Victoria in British Columbia advertised a public competition for the design and construction of Beacon Hill Park, overlooking the city. This was won easily by John Blair. He was now 68, wasn't about to retire. He started on this large project in 1889. He hired another Scot, George Fraser, to assist him. And there in Beacon Hill Park, he created again a lake called Goodacre Lake and a beautiful rustic stone bridge, which is still known as Blair Bridge. He loved bridges and ponds. Again, in that park, he created rustic bowers and seats using natural tree limbs formed together. He continued working into his 70s. His last assignment was the 20 acres of Sir James Dunsmuir's home, which was called Burleith. And as the local paper reported then, quote, "The grounds were skillfully laid out under the magical hand of Mr. Blair." Shortly before his death, remember he died at the age of 86, he was nominated to superintend the landscaping of Stanley Park in Vancouver. I think the fact that the city placed so much confidence in John Blair at the age of 86 speaks volumes for the respect in which he was held professionally. When he passed away in 1906, a commemorative article appeared in one of the Chicago papers, and I quote, "Mr. Blair was born in Scotland. He talked with a broad Scots accent. He was hearty and rugged. He was one of the most lovable of men. Those who know him are the better for having known him. He was one of the old settlers of Oak Park, a generation that is fast passing away. He has left the imprint of his genius on many places in the New World, and even those who never knew him are benefited by his works." One of the flowers he loved was the rhododendron, and the Royal Horticultural Society has identified a species that he cultivated and christened it the John Blair rhododendron. I want to read six lines from a poem written about John Blair 10 years before his death. This was a very special man. Has anyone ever written a poem about you and published it? Maybe there's still time. Okay, here is this extract from a poem. Quote, Few men have lived a better life, nor one whose deeds more truly grand have been to benefit mankind, than crowns the honored name you bear, and few whose works so long shall live as thine, my honest friend, John Blair. Today we celebrate the original taming of the primitive wilderness that was this valley and its transformation into a thing of joy and beauty. The architect of all of this was John Blair. Thank you.
One thing I am struck with by this brief history of John Blair is that he saw that his home was all of the creation that God had created, and he did not know John Blair, landscape architect and gardener for General William Jackson Palmer. It was situated on the mesa overlooking Glen Erie Reservoirs and the Glen Erie Entrance. It has been dedicated to the memory of John Blair in the presence of his great-granddaughter Irene Bergman, and his great-great-granddaughters, Louise Millman and Judy Whitaker, on this, the 25th day of July, 1997. And those are the words of the dedication. Would you like to come up and take a look? Do.
Everything that we and the navigators do, we incorporate the Lord into it, and for the first time in my life, I have written out a prayer that I would like to pray just now, just so all the special thoughts of the time together can be expressed to Him. Shall we pray? Father, we stand in awe of your greatness, expressed in the work of your hands all around us. And we thank you for the rich history of this property, for General Palmer and his vision, his insight, his foresight, and his wisdom to see this valley for what it could be. Thank you for bringing John Blair into contact with General Palmer at the right time, and for the talents and the abilities that you endowed him with. He made such a significant contribution in laying out the valley for its buildings and designing its gardens to make it such a delightful place, rich in color and plantings. Thank you also for those who have contributed over the years, like the Burkhart family, and now Katie and the Garden Society, so that many might continue to enjoy the beauty of this valley. So we dedicate this building, used by John Blair and many others through the years. John went from it to enrich and enhance British Columbia and other places with the skill of his hands. May those who go from it now and in the future enrich the lives of multitudes by making your name and your love known around the world. So we dedicate this building to the memory of John Blair and to your glory in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Just a few announcements. Dave and Terry Legg, who are the present occupants of the building, two people on our staff, have come up from Florida to live for a few years, have graciously made it available to us to walk through and enjoy the interior of it. And fortunately, there's a door on the far side of it through the kitchen that allows us to go out and circle around without getting bogged down. Then there were some refreshments on a table down here. We also want to promote the viewing of the Rose Garden down below us. And I would suggest, if you do want to go down and take it in, that you go down to the corner of the pink house here and then take some stone steps down to the front entrance of the garden. We've had to put a wrought iron fence around the garden to keep the deer from consuming all of our work. Now, one thing of local interest, since you're interested in this kind of thing, Ginny has given me some pamphlets on Founders Week, which is coming up this next week starting, and there are numerous things of interest for people of the city, and we'd like you to have one of these. And then a very, very special treat. I wonder if Katie would be like to help me pass these out. I had asked Mr. Bill Dale if he would make up some bookmarks that would have the Blair Bridge on it, a little stone seat that sits over beyond the Rose Arbor, and then a picture of Mr. Blair. And he cordially assented to doing that. And I would like everyone to have a copy, just as a memento of the day.